Thank you and good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to also welcome everyone on the Cybercast. Thank you for joining us today. Are you tired? Do your feet hurt? Are you all dusty and dirty? I didn't think you'd say yes to that one. How about are you a bit thirsty or hungry? If you were an Israelite roughly 4,000 years ago, you would more than likely have answered yes to all of those questions. You see, just a few short days ago, on the first day of Unleavened Bread, the children of Israel had left Egypt and headed out towards the Promised Land. They had witnessed amazing, spectacular feats. They saw the mightiest, the strongest, most powerful nation on the earth literally fall to its knees and beg their lowly slaves to leave them. They were free. They were headed towards the promised land, the land that flowed with milk and honey. But instead of taking the direct route through the land of the Philistines, God led them through the wilderness. He had reasons for that. And right around this time, today, close to the end of the Festival of Unleavened Bread, they would have been approaching the Red Sea. And the Bible isn't clear on exactly when the Red Sea crossing happened, but it would have been close to this time. So let's pick up the story. Please turn to Exodus 14 to start. Let's notice where the Israelites were. Again, right around this time, towards the end of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, as they approached the Red Sea. Now, God is going to cause an event to happen here to prove to Egypt that He was the only God, to make absolutely no doubt, or to leave no doubt in anyone's mind. He was the only one true God. So let's pick it up in verse 3, Exodus 14, verse 3. Here, God is speaking to Moses, and he says, "For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, 'They are bewildered by the land, and the wilderness has closed them in.' Then I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord." And they did so. Continuing verse 5, "Now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people, and they said, 'Why have we done this?'" Apparently they already had forgotten the 10 tremendous plagues that God had poured out upon them. So again, God was making one final point here. "Why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us?" So he made ready his chariot, took his people with him. Also he took 600 choice chariots, and all the chariots of Egypt, with captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with boldness. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them camping by the sea, next to some places that are hard to pronounce. Verse 10, "And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them." Now let's stop right here. If I were in their position, I probably would do the same thing. Let's notice what they did. They were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Let's put ourselves in their shoes for just a moment, or into their sandals, if you will. Their fear is justifiable, isn't it? They just left the greatest nation on earth as slaves. They were used to being beat down and abused, if you will. You can see the dust being kicked up by all the chariots. As it got closer, you might have even felt the earth shake a little bit with the thundering of the horses pounding the dirt, the sand. And there you are, between a rock and a hard place, literally between two mountains and a sea. Now, the Red Sea is really nice. My wife and I had the opportunity to travel there a few years ago for the feast. I even went scuba diving in the Red Sea. It's just beautiful. But if I were in the Israelites' position between two mountains with the sea in one hand, I wouldn't have liked the sea very much at that point. So they were afraid, and they cried out to God for help, didn't they? Or did they? Let's notice the next verse. They cried out to the Lord, but what did they say? They weren't asking for help, were they? Verse 11, then they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us out of Egypt? They weren't asking for help, were they? They were complaining. In fact, they wanted to go back to Egypt where they were slaves, even after witnessing all those miraculous plagues, the death of the firstborn. You have to remember the context. Less than a week before this point in time, say 3, 4, 5 days, all of the firstborn of the mightiest nation in the world had died. Not even a week ago. They hadn't learned their lesson, had they? They were afraid, and instead of crying out to God who had led them out of Egypt to save them, they complained. So we know the story. God miraculously opened the waters, Israel walked through, and then he destroyed the entire Egyptian army. So let's pick it up at the end of chapter 14. Let's notice the conclusion. Verse 30. Exodus 14, 30. So the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Thus, Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt, and so the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. So Israel learned their lesson. They finally believed and feared God, didn't they? It says so right here. Problem solved, lesson learned, right? Let's move on. Chapter 15. Here we have a song of Moses. They were obviously very excited. This was an incredible time, an incredible event that had just taken place. But let's notice verse 22, Exodus 15, 22. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and then they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. Again, another big problem. 3 days without water, their water supplies certainly would have run out. Big problem. Verse 23, now when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, the name of it was called Marah. So let's think about this. They had just learned their lesson, right? 3 days before this occurrence here, no water, God had led them through the Red Sea. Do you think that would stick out in your mind? You know, you're walking through the Red Sea, two huge walls of water, you had fish falling out. Incredible events. That's never happened to anybody. They'd never seen that before. 3 days. Not very long. But what did they do? Verse 24. And the people complained against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? Again, we see the same issue. They didn't cry out for help. They didn't say, God, we know you can save us. Please help us. They complained. Exodus 16, verse 1. And they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai. And on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt, then the whole congregation of the children of Israel, guess what? Complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness because they had no food. Did you notice the date? It says the 15th day of the second month. 4 weeks after they left Egypt. Just say 2 weeks after the waters had been fixed. 2.5, 3 weeks after the Red Sea. Not long. They still didn't get it. We could go on and on. Chapter 17 lists another example. And here, this is what really stands out in my mind. Chapter 17, we'll just read it. Verse 1, Then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Lord, and encamped in Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Hadn't this happened before? It was the exact same issue that they faced just a few weeks before. It wasn't a new one, a different test. It was the exact same issue, wasn't it? And again, verse 2, it's the same exact thing over again. Therefore, the people contended with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." So Moses said to them, "Why do you contend with me, and why do you tempt the Lord?" And the people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses and said, "Why is it that you have brought us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" Same thing. They didn't get it, did they? Brethren, what's the lesson that you and I can draw from these examples? What attitude were the Israelites displaying over and over again? What's the lesson that they didn't get? At the heart of this issue, you can boil it down, is fear or fearfulness. They were afraid, weren't they? And again, a lot of times with good reason. I mean, they had the Egyptian army bearing down on them. They had no water, no food. Those were serious necessities, weren't they? But why is being fearful such a big deal? I mean, again, it's a natural feeling, isn't it? Well, let's ask a question. What are we demonstrating to God when we're fearful? Isn't it that we show Him that we don't trust in Him to help us or protect us? Thus, fear fundamentally demonstrates and shows a lack of faith, a lack of trust in God to take care of us, protect us, give us what we need. So if we're fearful, then we're not trusting in God to look out for us. So then, who are we looking to? We're trusting in ourselves, aren't we? We're trusting in ourselves, and we're saying, we're looking to ourselves to help us out of this situation, and we're saying, we can't do it. So we're afraid. The children of Israel knew they couldn't fix those waters. They couldn't do it. They were looking to themselves to try and save themselves, and then became fearful because they knew they couldn't do it. And brethren, this is the reason why that the cowardly is on that list in Revelation 21, verse 8. It says the people that won't inherit the kingdom of God. And that's always kind of stood out in my mind, because if you read that scripture, there's a lot of, say, bad behavior listed there. You have the abominable, the murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, etc. But the very first one is the cowardly. Why is that? I mean, being a murderer is horrible, right? It is. But what's so bad about being cowardly? Again, it shows a lack of trust in God, doesn't it, at its very core. So, brethren, God wants us to trust Him. No, in fact, He demands that we trust Him. But here's what's so encouraging, brethren. Here's what we're going to focus on today. God is working with each and every one of us to help develop and increase our faith and our trust in Him. Because without His help, we couldn't do it. Without Him, we would do exactly the same as the Israelites did back when they left Egypt. We would do the exact same thing, guaranteed. Because you can't do it without His help. So, brethren, today we will examine three aspects of how God grows our faith. So let's start by taking a look at the goal. That way we know where we're headed to. What's the goal? How should our faith look? What should it look like? You know, when we think of the subject of faith, we normally think of the New Testament, right? But in fact, today we will be spending almost all of our time in the Old Testament, because there's so many examples, so many scriptures that talk about this, and many other so-called New Testament concepts. So let's turn over to Daniel 3. Daniel 3, here we see a profound demonstration of what our faith should look like, how it should be expressed. So we'll define our target. What should it look like? Daniel 3. And we'll just jump into the middle of the story here of the fiery furnace. And notice verse 16, Daniel 3:16. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. Again, you have to remember, this was the most powerful king ever. He was essentially God on earth. In fact, he thought that, and he got punished for it. But here they are very bold, aren't they? Let's notice verse 17. If that is the case, our God, who we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. That's our goal. That's our goal, right there. Very clear example. We must have this cool, quiet confidence in God that he knows what's best for us and that he will help us and will do what's absolutely right for us in our lives. It might not necessarily be the answer that we're looking for at that moment, but God is always looking and taking care of, looking for us, looking out for us, I should say, and taking care of us. So that's the goal. That's what our faith should look like. I've never been threatened to be thrown in a fiery furnace. That's an incredible obstacle. But that's what I hope to be able to demonstrate, if that were ever the case. That cool, quiet confidence that God might not save me. I don't know exactly what his plans are, but I do know that he has my best interests at heart. So how do we get there? That's our goal. That's what we're striving towards. But how do we get there? Let's look at another story. We'll dive into this one a little bit more deeply in the Old Testament again. In the Judges, in fact. This was a time in Israel after Moses and Joshua had died. They were kind of leaderless, if you will. And there was a consistent pattern throughout the Judges, if you read the story, where the Israelites would forget God for a while. They'd go and do whatever they wanted. They'd worship other gods. They'd fall away. And God would send some nation or some pestilence to wake them up, to punish them from what they were doing. And they would cry out for help. God would send somebody to help them, and the cycle just repeated itself. So let's notice Judges 6. We're going to be looking at the story of Gideon today. The story of Gideon. I just love this story. It's fantastic. It has so many aspects to it, many different ones, but we'll be looking at the aspect of faith today. So again, the first aspect that we already mentioned is that God helps us develop our faith in him. We don't do it by ourselves. God helps us. So let's start in Judges 6, verse 1. Here it says, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. Because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made for themselves the dens, the caves, and the strongholds which are in the mountains. And so it was that whenever Israel had sown, the Midianites would come up, also the Amalekites, and the people of the east would come up against them. Then they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza and leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents, coming in as numerous as locusts, both they and their camels were without number, and they would enter the land to destroy it. So Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. So they were in some deep trouble, weren't they? I mean, they tried to produce food, and they couldn't because these Midianites destroyed everything that they had sown and wanted to reap, so they had no food. It was a very, very difficult time. But let's jump down to verse 11 now. Here God raises up a judge to help them, to right them back to his way, and also to punish these foreign nations. Verse 11. Now the angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth tree, which was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Ezbarite, while the son of Gideon threshed wheat in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites. You ever stop to think about that? It's a funny picture in my mind. Threshing wheat is not easy to do by hand. He was trying to do it in a little winepress. Incredibly difficult. And the reason was he was trying to hide it, as it says here. Unbelievable. I mean, not very efficient if you think about it at all. But verse 12, the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, "The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor." So we notice right from the start that God is encouraging Gideon. That isn't exactly what Gideon would have said about himself. He didn't consider himself a mighty man of valor. But again, God's encouraging him. He's starting to work with him. And again, from the beginning, he helps develop Gideon's faith. Verse 13. Gideon said to him, "Oh, my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all of this happened to us? And where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt?' But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hand of the Midianites." That's a little bit of a problem, isn't it? Gideon failed to see the reason for the punishment. He didn't see the cause. He didn't realize Israel was doing this to themselves. They had forsaken God. They were worshiping other gods, doing evil things, and so God let them be punished. Verse 14. Then the Lord turned to him and said, "Go in this might of yours," again, encouragement from the very beginning, "and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you?" Verse 15, so he said to him, "Oh, my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house." Again, Gideon didn't think of himself as a mighty man of valor. No, he was the weakest one, or at least so he thought. And the Lord said to him, "Surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat the Midianites as one man." Then he said to him, "If now I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who talk with me." This is the interesting part, because here Gideon reveals his lack of faith. Gideon didn't take God's word for it, like, say, Abraham did. Abraham believed from the beginning. Gideon wanted a sign. "Give me a sign so I know that you are with me." Let's notice the sign. Verse 18, "Do not depart from here, I pray, until I come to you and bring out my offering and set it before you." And he said, "I will wait until you come back." Verse 19, so Gideon went in, prepared a young goat and unleavened bread from an ephah of flour. The meat he put in a basket, and he put the broth in a pot, and he brought them out to him under the terebinth tree and presented them. The angel of God said to him, "Take the meat and the unleavened bread and lay them on this rock and pour out the broth." And he did so. So he prepared this offering. But let's see what happens next. See if this has ever happened to you. Verse 21. Then the angel of the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in his hand and touched the meat and the unleavened bread, and fire rose out of the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread. And the angel of the Lord departed out of his sight. Has that ever happened to you?
Yeah.
It was a great miracle, wasn't it? I mean, fire literally just came out of the rock, consumed the whole thing. It had been drenched in broth. Kind of reminds us of Elijah, doesn't it? With that offering, fire coming from heaven and consuming the entire thing. Amazing sign, wasn't it? Gideon, verse 22, perceived that he was an angel of the Lord. So Gideon got it. He said, "Okay, this is a sign. It's a miracle. There's no way this could have naturally happened. This is an angel of the Lord. I believe it." So Gideon said, "Alas, O Lord God, for I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." So he still had fear, didn't he? Now he was afraid that because he had seen the angel of God, that he was going to be punished or die because of it. Then the Lord said to him, "Peace be with you. Do not fear. You shall not die." So Gideon built an altar there to the Lord and called it, "The Lord is Peace." To this day, it is still in Ophrah of the Ezbrites. So Gideon received this sign. It took a little bit of convincing, but he did believe it, didn't he? And what's interesting here is you don't see God blast Gideon for his lack of faith. we see God patiently work with him and encourage him again from the very beginning. God knew exactly where Gideon was at in his development of faith. His level of faith was pretty low, we could say, right? But God is patiently working with us, just like with Gideon, to grow our faith, no matter how low or high or whatever you want to call it or quantify it. Gideon didn't need a sign to know what to do. He knew what God wanted him to do. God had said that he wanted Gideon to deliver Israel from the Midianites. Gideon didn't argue that point. He knew what needed to be done, but he just wasn't sure that God was with him. He didn't think he could do it. Again, what did we say at the beginning? If you're fearful, then it means you're trusting in your own abilities, doesn't it? Gideon said, I can't do this by myself, so I'm afraid. He didn't have that faith in God built up yet. Let's notice 2 Timothy 2, a very, very important point. Second Timothy 2. And let's notice verse 13. So here it says, even if we are faithless, even if we have no faith, he remains faithful. He cannot deny himself. Brethren, it doesn't matter what our level of faith is at right now, today, low or high or anywhere in between. God works with us. He helps us and wants to grow our faith. So again, the first point was that God himself helps develop and grow our faith. It's not something that we just do by ourselves, because we can't. We can't just do it of our own. Let's notice the second point. God starts small. God starts small. God starts growing our faith in small ways at first. And he always starts in smaller ways that are close to home for us. If you remember the story of David, God didn't expect David to conquer the giant at the very beginning, did he? It wouldn't work that way. Because David had a great deal of faith in God. I mean, he was a man after God's own heart. But that wasn't the first act of faith that David had ever done in slaying Goliath. If you read the story, God started small with David and worked him up till he was able to even kill lions and protect that little flock of sheep he was carrying. So David had no doubts about taking on Goliath, did he? None at all, but that wasn't his first act of faith, because God starts small. We have to develop that trust in him and build it, grow our faith. For Gideon, God instructs him to tear down his family's altar and build a new altar to the Lord. God started small. Let's go back to Judges and pick the story back up. Judges 6. God starts small. So God had given him a sign, and here was his first task. Let's notice verse 25 of Judges 6, verse 25. Now it came to pass the same night that the Lord said to him, take your father's young bull, the second bull of 7 years old, and tear down the altar of Baal that your father has, and cut down the wooden image that is beside it, and build an altar to the Lord your God on top of this rock in the proper arrangement, and take the second bull and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the image which you shall cut down. So Gideon took 10 men from among his servants and did as the Lord said to him. That's pretty good, isn't it? He actually went and did what God wanted him to do. Again, this was a small act. A small act. He didn't have Gideon go out and take on the whole army immediately. A small act, close to home, even though Gideon needed a sign. And the other thing to keep in mind is God did it immediately, the same day. He didn't let Gideon have a chance to let doubt creep into his mind. God knows what he's doing. It's amazing, isn't it? But let's finish the verse. I stopped short in verse 27 on purpose. But because he feared his father's household and the men of the city too much to do it by day, he did it by night. So Gideon wasn't quite there yet, was he? His faith was growing, but it was still pretty small. God started to grow Gideon's faith in his own backyard, close to home, with a small task. And in the same manner, God starts small with us. He gives us little tests of faith, and then slowly we build from there. Aspect number three. God makes us use our faith. God makes us use our faith. And this is really important. God is very patient. He really is. And he wants us to develop that trust in him, that faith in him, that he will take care of us. He has our best interests in mind. And he's willing to help us. He starts small. But we must respond. We must use our faith. Faith is like a muscle, if you will. It needs to be exercised. That's one of the reasons why we have trials, brethren, to exercise our faith. They help build our faith. Because we can't go through life not using our faith, if you will, and then expect to just whip it out of our pocket whenever a trial arises. It doesn't work that way. We have to constantly exercise it. Let's notice 1 Peter. First Peter 5. Here we see the value of faith. The value. Excuse me, 1 Peter 1, verse 5. First Peter 1, verse 5. Who are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials. So trials are a part of our growth as Christians. That the genuineness of your faith, and notice this, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Our faith is worth more than gold. It's incredibly valuable. And again, it's imperative for us to grow it, to let God grow it in our lives. We also know that faith without works is dead. So again, we need to exercise our faith. It needs to be worked out. It needs to be used. And not just let it sit stagnant. So we need to exercise it. So let's go back to the story. Back to Judges chapter 6. We'll see if Gideon exercises his faith. Let's see if he's learned his lesson. Let's notice Judges 6:33. We'll skip over a little part of the story here and go to verse 33. Then all the Midianites and Amalekites, the people of the east, gathered together, and they crossed over and encamped in the valley of Jezreel. But the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. Then he blew the trumpet, and the Abezreites gathered behind him. And he sent messengers throughout all Manasseh, who also gathered behind him. Also he sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and they came up to meet them. So here we see a conflict brewing. Gideon had a weak faith problem, didn't he? God gave him a sign. He had the little sacrifice that went up in smoke. Gideon then did the small task, the little task, tearing down that altar. Was he ready for prime time? Verse 36. So Gideon said to God, "If you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, look, I shall put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only, and it is dry on the ground, then I shall know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said." Gideon wasn't quite there yet, was he? His faith was still weak. He needed a sign. He had already been given a sign. He'd already completed a task that God tasked him to do, and it went successfully. His faith was growing, but it wasn't quite there yet, was it? Let's notice what happens. Did God beat him over the head? No, God was patient. And so it was, verse 38, when he rose early the next morning and squeezed the fleece together, he wrung the dew out of the fleece, a bowl full of water. So the fleece was full of dew, the ground was dry, the sign had happened, because that's obviously not possible physically. Okay, let's move on, right? Let's go save Israel. Wait. He wasn't quite there yet, was he? He needed another sign. And he knew he was pushing it. Verse 39, Gideon said to God, "Do not be angry with me, but let me speak just once more. Let me test, I pray, just once more with the fleece. Now, let it be dry only on the fleece, but on the ground let there be dew." And God did so that night. It was dry on the fleece only, but there was dew on all the ground. So even after that first sign, Gideon still needed reinforcement, didn't he? He wasn't quite there yet. His faith, although growing, wasn't quite up to par yet. But again, God was patient. God was growing his faith slowly. Let's jump over to chapter 7, verse 2. We'll get into the main part of the story here, where we have just a massive army. It's 120,000 men against Gideon. He had 32,000, so those aren't very good odds, are they? 120,000, 30,000, it's about 4 to 1. Those aren't very good odds. But Gideon had the sign. So now he had faith. Everything was going to go well. Verse 2. And the Lord said to Gideon, "The people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.'" After Gideon heard this, he must have thought, "You've got to be kidding me. I only have 30,000, 32,000 people, and you're saying it's too many." Unbelievable. So what happened? Verse 3, "Now therefore proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, 'Whoever is fearful and afraid, let him turn and depart at once from Mount Gilead.' And 22,000 of the people returned, and 10,000 remained." Now he's down to really bad ratio, about 12 to 1, 120,000 against 10,000. Not very good odds, are they? But notice, we don't see any doubt or questioning from Gideon. He didn't say anything. "But the Lord said to Gideon, 'The people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. Then it will be that of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, the same shall go with you, and of whomever I say to you, this one shall not go with you, the same shall not go.' So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, 'Everyone who laps from the water with his tongue, as a dog laps, you shall set apart by himself. Likewise, everyone who gets down on his knees to drink.' And the number of those who lapped, putting their hands to their mouth, was 300 men. But all the rest of the people got down on their knees to drink water. Then the Lord said to Gideon, 'By the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and deliver the Midianites into your hand. Let all the other people go, every man to his place.'" So the army started at 32,000, went down to 10,000, is now down to 300. Unbelievable. Again, God was trying to make a point. In fact, in chapter 8, verse 10, he says he wants to do it to his glory. He wanted to make it clear that this wasn't Israel doing this. This was God. But again, notice, Gideon is not recorded, at least, to have questioned God. "Why are you doing this, God?" not possible. Gideon's faith had grown. It wasn't quite there yet, but it had grown. If you compare this to how he acted at the beginning, God was working with Gideon and growing his faith. Now let's notice verse 9. Jump down a few verses here. And it happened in the same night that the Lord said to him, "Arise, go down against the camp, for I have delivered it into your hand. But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with Purah your servant, and you shall hear what they say, and afterward your hands shall be strengthened to go down against the camp." This is really interesting. Because again, without Gideon saying anything, God gives him one more opportunity for encouragement. He says, if you still aren't quite sure, go down to the camp. You're going to hear something that'll convince you. And so he did. He went down with Purah's servant to the outpost of the armed men who were in the camp. Now the Midianites and the Amalekites, all the people of the east, were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number as the sand by the seashore multitude. And when Gideon had come, there was a man telling a dream to his companion. He said, "I have had a dream. To my surprise, a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian. It came to a tent and struck it so that it fell over, or it fell and overturned, and the tent collapsed." Then his companion answered and said, "This is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. Into his hand God has delivered Midian and the whole camp." And so it was, verse 15, when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation, that he worshipped. He returned to the camp of Israel and said, "Arise, for the Lord has delivered the camp of Midian into your hand." So again, God gave Gideon this form of encouragement. Gideon didn't ask for it this time. God gave it to him because God was growing his faith. Still wasn't there yet, but it was getting bigger and bigger. So Gideon surrounded the camp with 300 men. We know the story. Torches under pitchers. And then just because of the confusion that they caused, the camp literally fell into chaos, and Gideon had a huge victory that day. But it was clear, it wasn't Gideon that did it. It was God, because God had whittled down the army to 300. So Gideon responded to his calling. It took a little bit. God had to grow his faith. But in the end, Gideon accomplished his task. Brethren, this story has a happy ending. Did you know, did you remember that Gideon is mentioned in the faith chapter? Hebrews 11:32, if you want to make a note. The Gideon that we first read about at the beginning of the story would not have been recorded in the faith chapter. He would not have made it. He didn't have enough faith. Now did he? He needed sign after sign. But God helped him build his faith to the point where he was very useful to God, wasn't he? Through Gideon, he demolished the other armies that were plaguing Israel. And again, it's finally mentioned in the faith chapter. It's an incredible journey that we witness from a man without faith to a man that's mentioned in the faith chapter itself. Brethren, God doesn't want us to be fearful. He demands that we trust in him, that we place our confidence with him, that we have that cool, quiet confidence that he will take care of us. We don't always know how it will turn out, just like the men with the fiery furnace didn't know for sure if God would save them, but they knew that God would do what was best for them. And it's so very encouraging, isn't it, that through the example of Gideon, God shows us that he works with us. He grows our faith. He's patient with us. He starts in small ways, close to home, and then slowly but surely builds us up to the point where we are giants of faith, if you will, till we also are worthy of being mentioned in a chapter of faith. Let's conclude in Hebrews chapter 13. And let's notice verses 5 and 6 to conclude. Hebrews 13, 5 and 6. Again, a promise from God that is sure, that we can take hold of and have complete confidence in. Hebrews 13, let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. For he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? So, brethren, let's remember that God always is with us. He'll never leave us, never forsake us. But here's what's important. Brethren, let's let God grow our faith.